Many guidebooks will direct you to fun activities in the outdoors, from less strenuous walks in the woods to extreme snowboarding. There's plenty to do and plenty to read about outdoor activities written from a man's viewpoint. Our next guest noticed the perspective and chose to add her own. Ruby McConnell is the author of A Woman's Guide to the Wild, Your Complete Outdoor Handbook. Ruby describes herself as writer, dancer, and geologist. Her written works include published professional papers on geologic matters. For general audiences, she writes short stories, essays, reviews, and a blog called Girl Gone Wild. She lives in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange, Ruby McConnell.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Lots of books out there by men for men in the wilderness. Have you pretty much had the field to yourself in writing a book from a women's perspective?
Apparently so, and that's part of what motivated me to go ahead and write it myself. I was looking for something in a female voice and couldn't find it.
Who and what got you into the wild in the first place?
I grew up in Oregon, so And I grew up in Portland, so I grew up in that sort of urban wilderness dichotomy of being from Portland. So you're always sort of out in nature, out in Forest Park. And then I got sent to a summer camp as a kid that I absolutely took to and got funneled through outdoor school. You know, Oregon is sort of set up to indoctrinate its young people into the outdoors, and then ended up a geologist. So I was working outside as well.
This might be the only state in the union that has a ballot measure ever about requiring outdoor school for kids.
You know, absolutely.
That's on this November's ballot.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that people should support it because it's life-changing. Yeah.
So, but despite the summer camp, though, it sounds like when you first began to venture into the wild, there were a lot of things you didn't know.
Well, yeah. Oh, I was completely befuddled by most things. And most of the things that I talk about in the book, you know, they say that all of the warning labels on everything that you see are there because it has happened. And I wanted to communicate that in the book, too. I wanted to sort of lay myself out there and say, hey, I did this thing. And I'm just going to admit that I did this thing. I slept in a puddle. I had my food eaten by birds. And so then if it happens to you, you just go, oh, yeah, that happens to people.
But you didn't even know poison oak, for example, or couldn't read a topographical map?
No. I mean, I didn't have parents that were particularly outdoorsy, and you know, they liked the beach, and they liked to be outside, but they didn't have that skill set themselves. And then there's no coming-of-age rituals for young women in the United States where we might do that. Young men, that's considered an integral part of becoming an efficient, competent young man is to have mastered these skills. But more likely, the older women in our lives will give women a different set of skills based on their cultural tradition.
We were talking about shop class and home economics just yesterday.
Exactly.
About the fact that we were all educated differently, certainly years ago, and it sounds like it has continued to a large extent.
I think so, particularly with respect to outdoor pursuits.
So when you would travel with men, how was the help usually given when you asked for it?
Well, I mean, let me say this first of all. Like, I love the company of men, and I love the company of men outside. And my intent is never to say, oh, I was surrounded by these horrible men, because I was, in fact, surrounded by some really genuinely helpful, kind men that took time for me. But I grew up in the era where everybody's parents had a copy of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, right? So that sort of played out where a lot of the time, while the intent was to be helpful, there was such a dichotomy in the way in which information was passed along, and especially what it felt like men were wanting to get out of the experience, that even if they were trying to be helpful, it maybe came off as condescending or pushing too hard. You know, that aspect men really like, I think, to feel, I'm going to generalize here, like they are surviving and conquering in the wilderness. And my experience, and I think the experience of many other women, is that that attitude is frightening in the outdoors.
Mansplaining in the woods?
We don't want to feel like we're just surviving. We want to feel like we're relaxed and enjoying ourselves. But part of the fun for our male companions is that sense of adventuring and surviving and doing all of that. And so for them, it's fun. And for us, it's a little scary.
So there's even a different basic appeal, you think?
I think so. And it's not universal, of course. But I think that as a generalization, it's a good observation.
There are some fun quotes in your book, A Woman's Guide to the Wild, to start the chapters, like Thoreau wondering how women can stand being indoors so much.
Yes. I thought that was a great advocacy statement for us.
So, yeah, so obviously he was enjoying his time outside and thinking, well, gee, why don't the women come outside? Well, duh.
Right.
Have you invited them, perhaps?
Right.
All right, so how to get the novice started? I mean, before investing in camping gear or buying ultralight spaceman type hiking gear, what's a good starting point?
I encourage people to start with their what I call their homeland wildernesses. So those places that are close and accessible and safe and well labeled and super self-explanatory, that are short trips that don't require anything other than comfortable shoes and, you know, weather appropriate things. You're not going to end up in sort of a dangerous situation. Ashland is great that way, you know, you have easily accessible trails that become more and more wilderness-like as you progress into them, and it's a great way of practicing. So I tell people to sort of start all of these skills close to home, especially things like navigation. Don't try to learn how to navigate out in the wilderness. Learn how to navigate in your neighborhood first, because you're not going to get lost. You know, you'll be able to get back.
Good idea. Be able to get down to the end of the next block, turn around and come around the other side of the block and know where you are.
Do it with a map and compass instead of street signs. And then if you get lost, you can get back using the street signs.
How good is your own sense of direction? I didn't think to ask that.
It's pretty good. Geologists make the maps that we rely upon.
Of course, yes.
My sense of direction is pretty good. I tend to map in my head as I go. So I usually look at the map before I leave and then am able to sort of mark the landmarks and keep a sense of direction as I travel. I'm lucky in that respect.
Ruby McConnell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll learn more about her own travels and how she's helping other people travel out into the wilderness. Her book is called A Woman's Guide to the Wild, Your Complete Outdoor Handbook. You may have some questions or some stories you'd like to share with us. We would like to hear from you. Join us when we come back from this break, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Ruby McConnell and you in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Ruby McConnell of Eugene, writer, dancer, geologist. She describes herself. She had a blog, still has a blog, called Girl Gone Wild that's expanded into a book called A Woman's Guide to the Wild, Your Complete Outdoor Handbook, something written not from a men's perspective, about all kinds of fun outdoor activities. Join us on the Exchange if you have something to contribute or a question for Ruby. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. So explore your own neighborhood was the suggestion. If you have trails nearby the house, that sort of thing, and it apparently helped you out in Portland, exploring around your parents' home. Urban wild areas, then the gateway drug. What's the next step in the harder stuff?
So usually then, you know, I encourage people to do longer day hikes. So you're from short, easily accessible day hikes to longer day hikes where you have to do a little bit more preparation. You have to do a little bit more pre-planning. It might take longer to mobilize out. You'll have to think more about food and packing and safety gear. And then from there, you progress to car camping. You know, so you've got campsites that are easily accessible that you can find. There's a camp host. It lets you practice your camp cooking skills, your setup skills. You know, figure out what's comfortable to sleep on and all of those things.
And if you forgot something, you can drive out to a store.
You can drive out to a store. There might even be one. It's great if you have kids because it sort of helps corral them and is more familiar to them. There's a bathroom, which I think is a really big barrier for a lot of people, you know, and just sort of like sorting all of that stuff out. And then from there, you can take, you know, short overnights that are backpacking based, you know, add maybe an adventure sport into it if you are big into adrenaline, things like that.
Well, in fact, you give a list of activities broken into three, and then there's the low-key activities and the somewhat adventurous and the adrenaline-loaded adventure sports. So among the low-key activities, though, I mean, aside from you know, the basic camping and things, geocaching. which I've heard about a lot and never quite fully understood. What is that?
Yeah, it's a super great thing that people do in the wilderness. And I think they do it in urban areas, too. I'm not a geocacher, but they basically, it's like a scavenger hunt where there's different coordinates that you get. Sometimes some groups will do it just with sort of clues as well. But usually with geocaching, you're looking for a particular coordinate. And when you find that coordinate, there will be like an old lockbox or some sort of cache that then you open it up, and there's like trinkets, and you're supposed to sort of take a trinket and leave a trinket sometimes. There's a whole world of people who are looking for all of these geocaches that are out there.
Pokemon Go with something actually there.
I was going to say, I guess as I say this, it's like a primitive form of Pokemon Go that's been playing out.
In the somewhat adventurous category, a bouldering. What is that?
So bouldering is sort of a precursor activity to rock climbing. And I say precursor, and I have just probably upset all of the boulderers who will say...
No, it's more than that.
It is a standalone sport that is, in fact, distinct and different. It is not ropes-based. It's a different kind of climbing entirely, and I understand that. But the reason I make the distinction is because it is lower height, lower equipment, in some respects, than very much safer, less intimidating to get into, less of a buy-in of equipment to get to. So it's rock climbing, but it's sort of on low-level rocks.
Less technical and maybe a little more slanty?
A little bit more slanty, a little bit just closer to the ground, not as dangerous,
Okay, so bouldering is... And then among the adrenaline-loaded adventure sports, I mean, a lot of the things you'd expect in there, snowboarding. Sandboarding is in there, though, too.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Sandboarding's huge in the dunes in Oregon. And I think it's actually an international thing. They have international competitions now, and basically you're surfing on the sand dunes, and you're snowboarding on the sand dunes. And especially with middle school kids, it's really taking off. And these kids rip it up out there. It is amazing. And it's a good alternative if you're in a state that's slowly warming or drying up.
Ah, there's going to be more sandboarding, you're thinking, down the road.
I'm thinking so.
Okay. Is there a standard set of warnings for people heading out into the woods the first time, see your doctor before starting an exercise program, stuff like that?
Well, I mean, especially if you're going out into the backcountry. So the standard set of warnings is, remember that you are your own first responder. So
nobody else is going to be there quickly.
Right. So you take that on as a responsibility. Even if you are in the company of others, you are responsible for your own safety first. And that means that you need to have provided yourself with an appropriate set of skills regarding life-saving things. So you need to be able to have shelter, fire, food, first aid. You need to have some sense of how to do those basic things, or you will not be able to be your own first responder. So, whatever that is, and whatever the level of skill that you need for what you're going out to do, you have to take responsibility for that yourself.
Ruby McConnell is the author of A Woman's Guide to the Wild, your complete outdoor handbook. She looked around and discovered there weren't any other guidebooks like this written for women heading out into the wilderness. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, it's so exciting because of yesterday in the trails. And, I lived in Tequilma, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had no fear. I went out every day and walked, and no trail here. I don't care. I found my way. And one day I told my roommate, he was a woodsman, I go, look at that poop, like a cat. And he goes, no, that's bear poop. It's small. It comes out exactly like it goes in. That's a bear trail. I'm, whoa. And one day I went up to the top of the mountain, Hope Mountain, in the Siskiyou National Forest where I lived. I was so blessed to be able to live there. And I'm looking around and going, God, thank you, God, for this view, the Illinois River, and I hear crunch on the stick. I'm looking around, and I go, those are manzanita bushes. Bears like manzanita berries. And I always thought, well, if I meet one, I'll just say, hey, I don't hurt you. Don't hurt me.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Thanks for that, Jeannie. Good to hear from you. And she's you mentioned the reference to yesterday. Robert Moore, who wrote a book called On Trail, some deep thinking about trails themselves, was here to talk about his book. So I noticed, too, that there was a note there about Jeannie once thinking she was out collecting leaves. They turned out to be poison oak.
Oh, I think that happens a lot to people.
Does it really?
Mm-hmm. I think particularly as it changes through the seasons. I've gotten poison oak in the middle of winter off of roots.
Wow.
So there was no way for me to know what it was that I was really interacting with.
So what have been some of the surprises that have happened along the way as you've gotten to round out your own outdoor education a bit more? Things that you just sort of took for granted years ago and then realized, oh, you need to think about this before you go out in the woods.
Almost everything. I feel like every single piece of what I did, I could have had a lot more forethought about. The number one thing that was surprising to me was how easy it is to eat well. I was absolutely convinced that I had to eat sort of like canned beans and dehydrated soup. I was convinced of this, that there was some special, like, you know, it's all Tang and astronaut food that I had to eat in the wilderness. And then all of a sudden something happened and I went, well, how about just cooking normally? And I don't need special equipment for it. You just, you know, especially if you're car camping, just, you know, bring your old pots and pans.
But on a backpacking trip, what kind of stuff do you bring for food?
I bring real food. I mean, it really is amazing. You know, I mean, unless you're going to be out for weeks and weeks, and even then, you know, often you have care packages and you have places that you stop and you re-up, you know, And I hear this from a lot of people that do distance traveling. They go, yeah, I bring fruit. I bring fresh fruit, you know, because you eat that first and then it's gone. It's weight that's gone. It's like drinking water, you know, and bring real food because it's so much more comforting and so much more nourishing at some point that unless you're really doing it as an endurance event or you're trying to time yourself or you're really under pressure, be luxurious about it. You can.
Which brings up the term glamping, which doesn't surprisingly appear in this book. So it's a term that's been coming into use in recent years, which you call it an unfortunate term. What does it mean?
I take glamping to mean anything related to the movement of what I call sort of uber comfort in camping. So there's a revival of vintage campers sort of going on, particularly in like the 30 and 40
right.
something
mm-hmm.
age, which is funny, you know, because we associate it with a little bit of an older set. But they're doing, and they have like these great like mini pods that open up into, they're all sort of Harry Potter RVs where they look tiny and then they open up into like massive luxury, you know, and it intersects, I think, with festival culture where people bring like rugs and massive tarps and all of these things and disco balls and tent chandeliers.
Wow.
And they stay in like luxury, you know, teepees out by the national parks. And I think that there's indulgence in it. And then I also think that there's latent shame where people think like, well, if that's how I'm going to do it, then it doesn't count. And so one of the things I tried to do was say, you know what? You want to do it that way? If that's what makes you happy, if you need a disco ball in your tent in order to get you to go to a national park and appreciate the national park, then you disco ball as much as you want.
But you are also clear in the book that you want to stay in harmony with your surroundings and with your fellow campers as well.
Yes. So I do say do that as much as you want and do it someplace where it's not going to bother people who are looking for an authentic outdoor experience and do it someplace that is already developed and already disturbed so you're not taking pristine wilderness and even for a small amount of time really developing it.
I am so going to look for pictures of people with disco balls out camping now.
It happens.
It doesn't really. A Woman's Guide to the Wild is Ruby McConnell's book. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. The first chapter ends with women-only tours and trips. Are these becoming more common over time?
They are. It's really very exciting. And I think right now, actually, there's a new sort of conference that's happening called the Otessa Summit that's partnering with a bunch of different outdoor organizations. And really what they're bringing women together to do is to learn a bunch of different skills over the course of a 3 or 4 day period of time and let them try a bunch of different sports and take some workshops so that they get in an all-woman atmosphere with sort of a different style of learning and community building, that skill set that they're looking for so that they can then go do those things by themselves. But there's also this entire movement of women-only hikes and backpacking trips, and it's taking off everywhere. There's a great group called Great Old Broads for the outdoors.
I noticed the Great Old Broads for Wilderness.
They are so great. They are so great. And they're part advocacy, but they're also, you know, like that you talk to them and they're like, well, we're older ladies. We don't feel like it's as safe for us to be out by ourselves. We want companionship. There you go.
So you talk in chapter two about what to bring when you're heading out into the woods and wilderness. And so what are your thoughts on taking technology out there, disco balls aside? Because everybody's got their smartphone all the time now, it seems like.
My philosophy is bring your smartphone, use it as the tool that it is, which is an extra flashlight, an assistant to your navigation that is terribly unreliable with respect to your own brain, and a good map. You know, maybe a diversion, you know, maybe it's a great way of bringing a book with you and saving some weight. You know, it's certainly good for emergency communication. So use it for the things that it's usable for, and then turn it off and put it away.
I sense some disdain there for having to use an app to find where you are. You much prefer a paper map, it sounds like.
It's not for having to use it. It's that people rely upon it without understanding that the air associated with it is constantly changing. So the way that you are located in space with those apps has to do with the satellite's ability to locate you. So if you're in an area with poor coverage, the navigation that you're receiving becomes less and less reliable. And you don't necessarily know that that's happening.
Ah, okay. So with a map in hand, at least you can say, okay, here I am. I know I'm here. I can see these forks in the road.
Yes.
There's this route number right here. For the supplies you have to bring, though, on the what to bring section here, for backpacking and touring in particular, tell us about water purification supplies. I've always been curious about those.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that people underestimate how important this is, too. You know, and I'm old school, so I grew up doing, you know, iodine treatment, which makes your water taste, you know, pretty gross, and hand pump filtering, which is still a great and reliable way of doing things. But now there's all, you know, there's like all of these great technologies that do like instant purification, you know, as opposed to waiting for your water to boil for 15 minutes and things like that. And it's just getting easier and easier to make sure that your water is clean and have that be lightweight. So the ultraviolet treatment that people are using now. I think it's such a great alternative, and it's super reliable in terms of making sure that you're getting rid of all of like the bacteria and things that might make you sick. It's kind of great to be in the 21st century sometimes.
Well, and for nothing other than the fact that you get great advice like what you offer here. There's a whole section which applies not just to women camping, but finding the perfect fit for a sports bra. This is a great public service you're providing, whether people are going wild or not. I mean, what are some of the tenets you're looking for here?
I include that because the women in my life said that you have to include this because it's a real pain. And it is actually not something that I had even thought about myself, but I think that it's so uncomfortable for some women, and especially if you already have back pain due to like the load that you are carrying on your body anyway, and then you put like a backpack on top of that, if you don't have like you have to balance all of the weight that you are carrying. And I think that's where that becomes important, you know, where you're taking on another load along the same part of your body. And I don't think that that's taken into account when men are designing backpacks and load carrying.
Yeah, true. I mean, they have things they don't have to deal with
right.
when putting things on. Different options on shoes for the outdoors. How decide what's appropriate?
Appropriate shoes are shoes that you can walk in without bleeding.
That's a pretty easy
thing. Flip-flops are not appropriate shoes. Sandals are not appropriate shoes. You're looking for something that your mother would purchase you before going to summer camp. Still.
What would your mother buy? Okay, that's a good place to start.
It's true. I mean, women in particular, so many of our shoes are unreasonable. I mean, the real problem is that our day-to-day shoes are already unreasonable, and we can't walk distances or run or do anything useful in them. So then we try to take those shoes outside, and our feet bleed. And then we go, oh, I didn't have a good time on the hike.
Okay, let's make sure we change that. Deeper into the woods now, in your whole chapter on setting up camp, if you're at a dispersed site that's like not an official campsite, how do you decide where to go, and then what do you do about clearing yourself a little space?
Oh, geez. You know, it really depends on both the terrain and the vegetation. You want to look for something that's level. You want to look for something that doesn't have any overhead hazards. You want to look for something that's not a depression that might, you know, collect rainwater. You want to look for a place that you can fit your stuff, your gear and your site in and do the least amount of damage to the undergrowth and the forest. You want to look for something that has things like water within, you know, 200 feet, but not closer than 200 feet.
Okay. Important. Before we go, I want to make sure we because I did, this is a really fascinating section where you kind of blow up the whole menstruation in the woods with bears myth. And it's a myth, you say. So go ahead.
It's a myth. And apparently I'm the only woman in the United States willing to say the word menstruation in public. But I'm just going to keep doing it. Until we break down myth. I didn't start it as a crusade, but it is now. So the thing is, women are afraid to go into the woods because they think that if they are menstruating, they're going to be eaten by bear. Because we are told that if we are menstruating, we are going to be eaten by bear. So I thought if I wanted more women to go outside, I would just say, you're not going to be eaten by bear. It comes from, you know, two women that got attacked by a bear in Glacier National Park, and people sort of stood around and scratched their head and went, oh, maybe one of them was menstruating. But like, really, if you cook bacon, then you will attract bear.
Right. Okay. That's a great story about a guy who was busy cooking hot dogs outside. He's like, well, the bear's over here because you're menstruating. Well,
right. No, it's because you've just cooked a pound of bacon, dude. Like,
it's a real fun book. It's called A Woman's Guide to the Wild, Your Complete Outdoor Handbook. Ruby McConnell wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
A pleasure.